Hey, welcome to the second ever Saving Throw interview, and with me here tonight is Dr. Luke Meyer.
Woo, that's me. That's my name.
Yes.
Oh, I'm on the internet.
You are on the internet.
I'm kind of used to it, though. It's not as much fun as it used to be. Yeah. Well, I guess not as crazy, weird, cool as it used to be.
I'm still new to the internet.
Enjoy it while it lasts. The internet's wear off eventually.
Well, I've been writing this for 6 months, and I think I've got interacted with about 3 people who actually said they read it. I know I have readers. They just don't say anything to me.
They're just real quiet. Yep. Everybody has those ones who just lurk. They never post. They never respond. But they're out there. You see the hits. You know that they're there.
Yeah. Well, I think it's because I say nice things about games. I'm sure if I was rampantly negative, I would get interaction.
Yeah, there's a real key to getting interaction, and that is usually being wrong, being blatantly and horribly wrong, or stating a really strong, unpopular opinion. That will get you lots of interaction. Now, how you handle it will really determine a lot about the success of your, any media you put out there. Because there's a good way to handle it, and there's the bad way to handle it. Most people handle it the bad way.
Mm-hmm. Let's just go quickly into on here today. Tell me about the game you designed.
I designed a miniature war game called Iron Tyrants. It's a game of giant robots fighting. It's fast-paced, action-packed, it's intense, it's got tons of strategy, and I made it because I've played every giant robot game out there, I think. I'm fairly certain I have.
The DreamPod 9 stuff?
Yep, I played DreamPod 9, I played Battletech, played Cav, played Mechaton from Vincent Baker, played War Dogs from SJ12. I think there are a few random others. Some of them, most of them, in fact, are great games. They do what they're designed to do, but they weren't what I was looking for in a giant robot fighting game. So I eventually said, well, if no one's going to make the game I like, I'm going to make it myself. And then I did. Woohoo!
Woo. All right, that's a great little primer, but before we get really into the meat and potatoes Iron Tyrants, let's just sort of back up and get to know you, Dr. Meyer.
One of those times.
How'd you get into the hobby? What color was the box D&D came in when you started out?
Oh, man, I got in, it would have been, man, I guess the early 90s? I was in late junior high, and I made a new group of friends who, a bunch of them played D&D, and it was fairly regular at that time. They were playing second edition. Mm-hmm. And I tried to get into the group, and the DM wasn't letting new people in, and then it kind of crashed and burned anyway, so that lay dormant for about a year or so. And then we picked up my buddy's HeroQuest box set and started playing that. And that led into me running some second edition D&D for them, which went into Marvel Super Heroes, and I'm from a very small town, and that's about all we had. When I went to college in 97, that's when I was exposed to the grand world of White Wolf and Champions, all the other games that nobody in my small town ever ordered in. So from there, it's just exploded. For a while there, I was looking for the Holy Grail RPG, you know, the one that would do everything I wanted to do. So I was buying tons and tons of RPGs. I kind of got over that. Now I really buy stuff that I know I'm going to actually run. But it's given me a lot of exposure to a lot of different types of games and a lot of fun reads.
Any particular favorites you'd like to single out?
Oh, I've got a ton of favorites. Savage Worlds was my go-to game for a long time. I mean, that fits my jamming style perfectly. And it's real. Once you know the system, I mean, it's really easy to do stuff on the fly, which is my one of my favorite things. I greatly enjoy Burning Wheel. It's a very complicated system. It does things very differently. But what it adds for that complication is almost always worth it. And it is a huge hit in my current group. And I'm about to actually run a new campaign of that, starting up here before too awful long. I love Vampire, Masquerade, and Requiem. I like Houses of the Blooded. Those are the big ones that I really, really dig. When it comes to war games, I mean, Vor is my favorite war game of all time, which died pretty quickly with FASA, but it's awesome. Yeah, Great Rail Wars, also fantastic. I've played a ton of War Machine and Hordes. Love those games. Yeah. Those are probably kind of shotgunning my bucket list of favorite games there.
Shotgunning a bucket list.
I don't know.
That's quite the metaphor.
I mix them up. It's what I do. I'm a doctor. I'm allowed to do that.
I guess. Like, I did not go to – I have not finished any post-secondary education yet, so Clearly, I should just bow to you as the authority.
Yeah, you really should just stick to single metaphors. Don't try to mix them, and don't try any double entendres, anything like that. That is, south of your border, that would be illegal for you. So just keep you safe, keep it simple.
How do you get into sort of designing games?
Well, I mean, I think everybody plays a lot of RPGs and a lot of war games eventually gets into some bit of design. I mean, it eventually gets to the point, I mean, early on where it's like, hey, I like the combat from D&D, but wouldn't it be cool to have the powers from Vampire or the magic system from this, and you start mashing stuff up. And that's where it kind of begins. And then I just started fiddling with systems and coming up with different dice tricks and ideas for what I wanted to do. And, I mean, I've made a bunch of homebrew games over the years, stuff that never got outside of my group. And it was – I'm one of the hosts of the podcast. It's been around for a couple of years now. And one of my co-hosts, Adam, who is my co-partner in Spooky Outhouse Productions, the our production network and podcasting network, he was really intent when we got started that he wanted to publish something. And initially, because we focused so much on RPGs, the idea was – well, let's make an RPG. It's an easy sell. It's kind of what we do, and we already have a built-in audience. And that's where I hit a stumbling block because, again, I don't really want to make an RPG unless it's something that does something different or unique or just a different take on things. And at that point, I was like, you know what? There's really nothing. I got no ideas that are better than what's out there or something different. So, but I do have some ideas for war games, and he gave me a weird look, and I'm like, I got a giant robot game I've been fiddling with for years. And he's like, well, how do you do a miniatures game when we probably won't be able to afford miniatures right off the bat? I'm like, lots of games do it. We use counters. We'll figure it out. And we did. So he said, okay, make a game and we'll publish it. And I'm like, done. It wasn't quite that quick. It took about 18 months. But that was the beginning of it all.
But do you have any particular influences on the design of Iron Tyrants, either for the mechanics or the setting?
What do you mean? What games really inspired me along the way?
Games, movies, books, anything.
Oh, I mean, I'm a big fan of fast-paced action. So, I mean, any sort of intense action sequence from any sci-fi movie, you can pretty much take from it. I'm heavily influenced by the games I play. I really wanted some resource management in there because I think it adds a whole other level of gameplay. And I got inspired with that from War Machine and Hordes because that's kind of their deal.
Yeah.
And so I wanted it to be something that was kind of dynamic and kind of fun. And eventually that ended up being, besides just a couple, there's a couple different instances of resource management. One is the overload your tyrants have, which we can get into later. And another is you have a limited number of tactics die you can use during the game, which are used for multiple things. And how you use them will greatly affect how the game is played. I really intent on the game and making it full of interesting choices. I wanted the game to last about an hour. Like I said, I wanted it to be fast-paced, but I wanted there to be a lot of tough decisions. And there certainly are, where there's just... where you're kind of biting your nails like, well, I could do this, this, or this. I don't know which one's the right path right now. I've got to really think this one through. So, and I think I've achieved that pretty well.
Okay. What one thing is, you've said before on the podcast that you aren't a fan of anime, but you love giant robots. That's not something that often happens. Most big stompy robot guys are all like, oh, yeah, I saw Robotech when I was 8, and it was the awesomest thing ever.
Yeah, I actually, for anime, I did enjoy growing up Voltron and Robotech and Transformers. I think they probably had at least a little bit of influence on the game. For the design of the actual tyrants themselves, the giant robots in the game, I wanted to have kind of a retro, almost Transformers feel, where things are kind of clunky and kind of boxy, and it's not real sleek like you see in a lot of anime. But I thought I'd throw in some of that for a little variety too. So basically I have two different companies. One makes it's these big stompy 80s style Western robots, and the other half makes these pseudo sleek anime tyrants. So I got a mix in there, but you're right. I'm not a huge anime fan in general, but I mean, who doesn't love giant robots? And I mean, they're just awesome. Conceptually, if you ever try to fit giant robots into a military, I guess, what's the word I'm looking for here? Yeah, if you try to justify the like in real life having giant robots, you can't. It's a terrible idea. It would never work. But that's why you have fun fantasy games to play, where you get to push giant robots around the field and pretend that they are as awesome as they are in your head.
Actually, there's this funny thing. Who was it? A bunch of Japanese physicists actually sort of sat down and looked at the made-up numbers they give for Gundams, and it's like, yeah, if it's actually this size and that tonnage, it'd be about 6 feet into the ground after every step. It's completely impractical.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Now, not to mention the fact that they'd just be a gigantic target. I mean, you get something standing that tall on a battlefield, it's called an easy target.
It's like mortar fire? Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons the Iron Tyrants is completely based around the Tyrants themselves. We don't have any infantry or other vehicles for a couple of reasons. One, because of that, because trying to justify it is tough enough. Why mix it up? And then the bigger reason is the fact that I really don't like when games make your giant robot fighting game, and then you have infantry and vehicles taking the focus away. Like, I've never played a game where I just didn't want to play with the giant robots, so I said, well, screw it, we're just going to have the giant robots, and, you know, sure, there could probably be some infantry and vehicles on the board, but what fun is that? I want to see these big things blow each other up, and that's about it.
You create a game of big stompy robots doing all sorts of awesome things, and what kind of lame-o says, no, I want tanks and bombers?
Exactly. It's kind of cool. I mean, the miniatures look cool all mixed together in the battlefield, but taking the focus away from the Tyrants was something I didn't want to complicate. Plus, that could also bog the game down, and you have to deal with all kinds of different rules. I wanted something that was sleek and just flew, and while still maintaining both a lot of tactics and that feel of piloting a giant robot, of blasting through armor, that you're not just, you know, you're not just in a vehicle with a bunch of missiles attached to it. It feels like you're piloting this thing. And again, through a lot of playtesting and a lot of bouncing ideas off people, I think we came up with some really cool ideas. So, you know, you get into this intense, nail-biting game that lasts an hour of, you know, five or six Tyrants aside, duking it out or playing whatever scenario, and it's just intense. It really gets you thinking the whole game.
All right, so how do you bring all that feel down to a mechanical level?
Well, a lot of it was, again, making sure there were plenty of choices there, and that make sure the choices had consequences. And, well, I won't say that the consequences are ambiguous, that you're not exactly sure if it's going to be worth it all the time. You've got to weigh – I wanted to make sure you could weigh risk versus reward most of the time. For example, I mean, one of the biggest mechanics in the game is the overload mechanic. That is, every Tyrant can be pushed past its normal specifications at the cost of overloading it. When you do so, you gain a certain number of overload points as the turn goes on. You can basically, you gain these when you want to fire multiple weapon systems, when you want to rush extra spaces, several spaces or inches, depending on what you're using, because you could use a free board for this or just an open game table or a hex map. Or there are several, I mean, most Tyrants have abilities that are fueled by overload. So you're gaining this throughout the turn, and a lot of them you can gain a ton of overload really quickly. It's a matter of, okay, where's the cutoff here? How much do I spend to get some benefit before I get into the big risk territory? Because you only get rid of so much overload a turn, and at the end of the turn, that can come back to, you can damage your own Tyrant, you can kill yourself, you can lock down weapons, just, you know, hurt your movement. You can really limit yourself. And if you gain enough of it, because it sticks around from turn to turn, if you gain a ton of it, you're going to be stuck with that throughout the whole game. So if turn one you just go crazy and overload a bunch, then the rest of the game you might be fairly ineffective. So you have to weigh that out. Now, there are times, though, where you're going to want to do that, where it's like, okay, this is where even, you know, this is too good a chance. You know, I've got too good a shot at taking out this other Tyrant. I'm going to just put it all in, you know, put all my eggs in one basket and see what happens. And that's part of the fun of the game.
All right.
So, I mean, that was one level of resource management and keeping the decisions in the game. Other is the tactics die. Everybody starts with 10 tactics die at the start of the game. They're used for initiative because at the start of every turn, you get one default die, which all the dice are d10, which you roll for initiative. Highest one gets to decide who gets to activate their tyrant first, because it's an alternating activation game. You go with one tyrant, I go with one tyrant, till we're all done. You can pull up to three dice from your tactics pool to roll with that default die and total them all. And obviously, you're hedging your bet that way. And also, if you ever double your opponent's number and you're rolling multiple dice, you get to blitz, meaning you can activate two tyrants in a row or force him to. So you've got to choose when to use those and when best. Plus, those are used to fuel commander and faction abilities. Well, actually, just commander abilities now. You can use special abilities to kind of break the rules, but they cost you from this pool, which, you know, having the initiative is really, really useful most of the time. So you've got to weigh out at the start of every turn. Okay, how badly do I need to go first? So stuff like that.
Okay. Cool. So tell me about the setting of Iron Tyrants. A lot of effort seems to have gone into it, and I'm reading through the faction section of the book now, and I'm really sort of grooving on all these different ideas. So just sort of give my readers the short version.
The short version. Well, let me say that was the hardest part of the book for me, the faction chapter. I've created tons of settings and worlds for different RPGs I've run. I mean, it's what you do when you GM, right?
Yeah.
This is the first time I've ever had to put something out there and not been able to either retcon it or see somebody's reaction. You know, when you're just doing it for your group, it's easy to be like, oh, they don't like this part of the setting. I'll just change it. Yeah, I couldn't do that when you're publishing a game. So I really watched myself to make sure I had some good ideas, because the biggest thing you had to go for was I wanted to have three factions, and none of them could be totally good or totally bad. I wanted them each to be to appeal to different people, so people have somebody to root for and root against. So you have, basically, it's set in the far future through this giant gate world called Gate World Atropos. Going through the gate world, it's basically a big warp gate. It was the only way they could travel faster than light when they built it. Times have changed since then, and smaller gates have been built. But, I mean, this thing is, think of kind of like the Halo ring. It's gigantic. It's been terraformed so that it has an Earth-like atmosphere. And that was the way into the sector. Well, a few hundred years ago, things got cut off because of a plague and government corruption and a rebellion, and basically bad stuff went down. So it got cut off from the rest of the empire. So you've got this one sector in space with these three factions that end up developing: the Malleus Dominion, who are kind of your feudal lords in space, that was originally a military dictatorship. You've got the Confederated Planets of Aeshan, who seceded from the Dominion in a bloody rebellion. And then you have Thraxis, who are a society that is a meritocracy, who they were tired of the old status quo, where basically it was an old boys' network. And so they developed a bunch of scientists and one visionary got together to develop this equation, which would basically allow people to have levels in society, where the higher level you were meant the more you contributed to society and the more perks you got. And they have a society based on that, which, because as time goes on, people start to know how to game the system, it's very intrigue-laden society, very amoral, because morals aren't really factored into the equation too much. It's more about what you add to society. So we have, like I said, three kind of broad factions, and they're all fighting over the gate world at this point. There's been wars throughout the centuries, but they are fighting over the gate world because there's a signal from the other side, meaning that after all this time being cut off, that there's a chance they could actually reopen it, because it was damaged long ago, but they think they know a way to fix it. They just have to, you know, conquer it first. Each faction has its own plans. So that's what's included in the book. It's a big – we have a campaign set on the gate world to see who will dominate.
Tell me about the mechs. Can I call them mechs? Because some people get stuffy about calling them, they aren't mechs. They're Wanzers or Guy Mellips.
Sure. You can call them mechs. We didn't use mechs actually because we were pretty sure it was copyrighted. Looking back, I don't think it was. But oh well. So
well,
we called them pirates.
You should be more careful than BattleTech. They got sued for using the word droid.
That's true. They did. There are 20 mechs in the book, 20 tyrants. They're a relatively new creation in the setting. They've been around a little while, and each faction has access to every tyrant. I don't limit it by, oh, this faction has X number of tyrants. Basically, the manufacturers sell to everybody. Each one of those tyrants really has its own personality and plays differently. Some run very, very hot with the overload. Some run cool. some give you each really does play differently, have its own personality and kind of times when it will be useful or not. We include a lot of different scenarios so that even the lightest tyrant, which is, I mean, a couple shots from just about anything will take it out, is really useful because it is super fast. And if you can get to, you know, maybe one of the take and hold scenarios where you've got to get to areas quickly and take them, it becomes very useful. As opposed to the super heavies, we have the assault tyrants, which are just gigantic and just shots just bounce off them throughout most of the game. So, like I said, we have two different companies making them. Currently owned is who make kind of the boxy Western style robots, and they are all ballistics. They do missiles and cannons, and machine guns, basically big auto cannons. And then you have Koshi Industries, who do the more anime-style mechs, which are a little bit sleeker. And they use a lot more with the way of laser technology, and it's a little more advanced because that's when you get into using overload to power different weapons. Like your laser rifle, for instance, can be powered up to do more damage or to be armor-piercing or to increase rate of fire, depending on what type of laser rifle it is. With overload. So you get a lot more choices, but you have to be a lot more careful about how you use them too. So, like I said, you can use any combination of these tyrants on the board, and generally most sides are going to have five or six in most scenarios. Where you get the differentiation between the factions, like I mentioned earlier, you have a commander. Every faction has three commanders. You choose one to have trained your squad, and that will grant you a faction ability you can activate, commander ability you can activate. Each faction also gets a faction ability, which lets it do something unique, and then it also gives you a way to earn back tactics die. For instance, the Malleus Dominion, their faction ability is that they get to choose one tyrant on the board to become a paladin. And you can use, when it's dissipating its overload at the end of the phase, you can actually discard tactics die to get rid of overload. So you can really just heat that thing up, just pump it full of overload because you can get rid of it really quickly. And then if it kills any of the other, when it destroys an enemy tyrant, you gain tactics die back too.
Ooh, shiny.
Yep, so that's how that all is integrated. We worked really hard to make sure that all the abilities were fun and balanced. So, again, it's going to be one of those things where people immediately were going to have stuff that appealed to them, like, oh, that's a really cool ability, I want that. And I think it's going to be different for just about everybody. Speaking of shotgunning and buckets earlier, that was kind of with both the art style of the tyrants and the abilities. One of my goals was, you know, you can't please everybody all of the time, but I wanted to make sure that there was a wide variety of options that would appeal to different people and different type of gamers. So it's kind of funny when people flip through the book and they see all the tyrant designs, there's some, everybody will go, oh, wow, that's awesome. I'm like, oh, I'm not sure I like that one. Like, oh, look at that. That's fantastic. But for everybody, those are always different. I mean, there's no consensus. Even ones that I think are like, okay, that one was just okay. That's not my style. I put it in for other people. And people love it. Some people are like, wow, that's fantastic. I'm like, really? Cool.
All right, so do you have a favorite mech?
Oh, man. That's like asking me to pick a favorite kid, I think.
The house is on fire. You can only save one.
I think probably my favorite, the one I find myself taking the most, probably the Warhawk. It's a medium to heavy tyrant. Its big benefit, it can fly. It's got jets on it, so it can move around a little bit better. But it also has a pulse cannon and a laser rifle, which can both be really just pumped up with overload. So if you need to fry something, you can. You can do it really well. The downside is it might fry itself by doing that too, but I find myself taking them a lot because they're really good against even the heavier type of tyrants, because that armor-piercing laser rifle can at least do some initial damage. That pulse laser at full rate of firepower can just chew through things. So I find myself having the most fun with that. The high tyrant, the Juggernaut, I mean, also a blast. I mean, the Juggernaut can walk around and just basically just take shot after shot and be fine until it gets headshot, which happened to me in the last game I played, which is an instant kill. It's like, oh, I'm undamaged. Haha, I'm going to take you out. Oh, headshot.
Oh, do people like to yell boom headshot at you when that happens?
Yes, something like that. It was more of a point and laugh, kind of a Nelson from Simpsons, like a ha ha. I'm like, yeah, I know. It's the funny thing is originally there weren't even headshot rules. Like it was all my playtesters wanted that in there. So I'm like, yeah, okay, that's cool. Now I'm gonna have to go back and change it because I keep losing because of it.
Iron Tyrant, second edition, the game that Luke wins at.
That's right. I'm tempted to put up errata to have a less lethal version of headshots available, but I'm not gonna do that. I don't think it's far too early in the game's life for me to change it back to my play to just my particular play style. Look, people, it's my game. I want to win, so I'm changing the rules until I do.
How tempted are you to take your ball and go home when you go play this?
Not very tempted. It's always fun to see other people enjoying the game, and beating me, people seem to really, really enjoy. And it might be because I talk trash all the time. I'm so bad.
You are a trash talker.
Oh, I talk so much trash. It's all in good fun. But I think that it helps because when people beat me, they do feel really good about it because they beat the trash talker. And I'm a good sport. I don't care. I have fun win or lose. And, you know, most of the games I've played since the playtest has been done for several months now, most of the games I've played are demos where I'm really not trying to win. I'm just trying to show off the game and let them blow me up a little bit. So we had a local con here in St. Louis called Archon a few weeks ago, and it was the first chance I had to kind of play. The book had just been released. Some of the playtesters were there and some of the podcast listeners, and we ended up having some competitive matches, and that was the first time in a long time I got to do that, and that was a lot of fun.
All right, so I guess we can lead that into promoting your game. So what are you going to be doing for it other than just sort of dragging it around to cons? Where are you taking it?
Well, I mean, the big thing, we're selling direct online. That's irontyrants.com has a link to our store. It's Spooky Outhouse Production Store, which is sopstore.com. We've got a lot of online advertising going on for it right now. We're really hoping it's been out, you know, for about a little over a month now, and the books just went out, and I know several people were doing reviews, and we're kind of waiting for those.
I'm a several person doing a review.
Woohoo! Good, because we're waiting on it, because that seems to be like I've hit almost all the big miniature sites to release news about the release and stuff, and most of it is the common the understandable reaction of this looks cool, but I know nothing about it. I'd be buying it blind. And I tried to put enough up on the Iron Tyrants website to give a good impression about what the game's about. We're going to probably put up some video here soon, but I can completely understand that. So getting some reviews up and out there will definitely help that out. We're really working hard. We're not, because we're such a small company, we would like to make some profit on the game. So we're not going through a distributor at this point, especially because we're relatively unknown. So we're doing direct sales, but we want to really develop a strong community for the game here in St. Louis. So we're working hard to get on store shelves. We're meeting with different game store owners. And we'll be demoing the hell out of the game over the next few months. Just playing it a ton here. And we're also working to assemble a demo team of people who around the country who will do that at their friendly local gaming store. Try to get the book on the shelf, you know, demo for people, just get local communities going. We're looking to have a booth at Gen Con next year, and I think that'll be big. I love our book. I think it's absolutely gorgeous, and it's funny because everybody we show it to who knew we were making it but hadn't seen anything on it will get it and go, whoa, this looks like a real game. It's like they expect the production values on this thing to be so low, and they're not. I mean, it's gorgeous. And I think when people see the cover, it's a book you're going to want to walk over to the game store and go, whoa, what is this? And you're going to flip through it, and then you're going to buy it because it is awesome. Yeah. So that's the marketing plan right now. We've got banner ads up on a bunch of sites right now. But again, until we really start getting the reviews in and we get some people who aren't part of our, you know, demo team or part of the production team actually out posting about it in other places, I'm kind of limited. Like I'm on RPG.net all the time, and I would love to start a Iron Tyrants thread, but I can't.
You're on RPG.net all the time. I already feel bad for you.
Well, I stay away from tabletop open. I mainly stick to role playing open. I mainly go to the other gaming and video gaming, which are less trafficked, far less heavy traffic, and it's a lot less the signal to noise ratio there is a lot better. So you don't have to dig through a bunch of crap most of the time, but. But, yeah, just kind of waiting for it to catch on because I think I'm really, really happy with the game. I'm extremely proud of it, and I think when people play it, they're going to be hooked. It's a really good game, and I'm completely biased and bragging on myself here, but we came up with something that, I mean, when I've converted a bunch of old BattleTech players between playtesters and demos for people around here, you know, who are hardcore BattleTech players. They're like, wow, you know, this game's pretty awesome. I'm like, well, thank you, you know. And I'm not trying to say, hey, oh, it's way better than BattleTech. Don't play BattleTech. BattleTech's a great game. It's been around for 25 years for a reason. It's fantastic. It's solid. It's got tons of options. But again, it didn't do everything I wanted to do, and I think there are a lot of people out there who will feel similarly when they play Iron Tyrants, that they say, "Oh, I see what you did there." And I don't know. That's just my take on things.
Well, right now I'm trying to get my friends to play it with me. It's mostly coming down to scheduling. I've got a few people who would love to sit down, but it's
sure.
People who it's getting sort of an afternoon free to teach everyone the rules.
But, always, I'll tell you what, they'll catch on quick. Well, once you know the rules, you'll catch on quick. The basics are really simple. I've been really happy in almost all of my demos by either the second or third turn. I don't have to do anything anymore. I don't have to tell people anything. They just can go and play. Like it's
apparently headshot you.
Yeah, and headshot me. Yeah, that's what they do. It's not that easy to do. It's less than a 1 in 100 chance, and somehow it keeps happening to me.
It's karma.
It must be. It must be
from I bet Gary Gygax suffered many, failed many save or die rolls.
He must have. He must have. So yeah, I just it's just another option out there on the gaming market. I think we made something that's a lot of fun and will appeal to a lot of people.
All right. So where do you see this game going? Are you going to do expansions? Are you going to do fiction? A role playing version? What do you think?
As I am not a fan of military campaigns in RPGs, I cannot foresee an RPG in the future. I'm not saying it's completely out of the question, because we're all role players over here.
Yeah.
But it's not on the horizon. Right now, our focus is on creating miniatures, because we have the players pack up, the $5 PDF, where you can print out, you know, tyrant sheets that are filled out. We have paper miniatures you can fold. It's a trifold miniature. You can mount on a base and play the game and play just fine. That's how we demo. And a lot of people actually seem to prefer the paper miniatures, because it's a very low-cost alternative to actual miniatures.
Well, it's really easy to convince someone to spend, you know, whatever printing things out are and the time it takes to glue them together compared to, okay, drop $40 on these and then paint them. You need to use at least three colors.
Yeah,
no, exactly assemble, right. Then paint.
You're exactly right. But as a longtime miniature gamer, well, I love our paper minis. I really do want to get some real minis out there, and that's something we're investigating right now. We've got some options we're looking into. You know, it's really expensive to get into, basically start production on metal miniatures. You know, it's about, basically, to get the sculpt and the mold done, it takes around $500 or $600 per unit, sometimes a little bit more. Now, once you get that, you know, it only costs like a buck or two to make them. But that's why miniatures are so expensive, because making the molds and sculpting them costs so much. So we're looking to get around that, because that is when you have 20 units, you know, we don't have $10,000 just to plop down into this. So we are looking into to 3D printing and some other newer alternatives to see if we can come up with something that's more economically feasible and get us the product that we like. So that's step one. And getting the book out there, we want this to spread far and wide, and marketing is by far and away the most difficult part of this thing. So once we see how successful it is, and see if we can get some miniatures, we will see where we're going to go. I've got some ideas for, you know, expansions, basically new tyrants, new commanders, new factions, idea where the setting's going to go. But that's all I'll be a lot more willing to do that if I know we have a good fan base. You know, this is a hobby for me, and I love doing it, but I don't like spending time on something that will end up just be basically masturbation. I don't want to be like, oh, look, I made a supplement for a game that three people will buy.
I'm sure you could sell more supplements if there were space pirates.
There very well could be some space pirate factions in the future. In fact, there was originally a space pirate faction. We had to pare it down a little bit because it was getting a little too watered down. There's actually been a pretty big call. Like, several people have email me with interest about fiction. We've got Adam wrote one of the intro story, and
which I liked.
Good. I did too. And Andrew, our buddy Andrew Webb, wrote the story that introduces the campaign. And both want to write more for the setting, and then we've got some other people volunteering. So a fiction anthology in the future could definitely happen. Again, it really all depends on our success. And, I mean, let me just say we've been out for, you know, like I said, a month, and we have far exceeded expectations with our sales, because our pre-orders, we got as many pre-orders as we thought we'd get total in the first, like, 3 days. And then over the course of the next, like, 3 weeks, we're still in the pre-order phase. We just kept getting more and more. I mean, it was just phenomenal. And it's been a steady bit of sales since then. So it's died down a bit because the initial rush is over. And now we're getting to the part where we've got to really dig in and just get the word out that Iron Tyrants is awesome.
All right, so you started a production company for this game. Do you see that production company doing anything else?
Oh, yeah. The main thing the production company started for was really the podcasting network. But we always wanted to do publishing, like I said. So this is our flagship product. Adam's working on some stuff. We've got some other local guys who are working on some stuff. I don't think all of it will come to fruition, but some of it, there's some really cool ideas out there. And I think we've got some awesome products in the future, some new game lines, a couple RPGs are in early stages of development. So, I mean, that's definitely an option. Also, I know there are several other members of the Spooky Outhouse Network who are working on projects. And I know one in particular I can't tell you about, but I'm really excited about, that is for Dungeons & Dragons 4th Edition, that will be phenomenal when it gets released. And I think it's more of a win. I'm not privy to a lot of the info. Adam drops hints because he's kind of involved with it. But when we, like I said, we're planning on having a booth at Gen Con next year. And if we're lucky, Iron Tyrants won't be the only game being sold. I think we might have something else up there too.
Oh, come on. Can't tell me more.
I wish I could, but it's if I spoiled the project that I'm not even supposed to know about. Well,
all right, tease me with one of these other things in early production. You got?
I can tell you. Paul has been working on it. Paul is a buddy of ours who we've gamed with the last couple years here. He's also on the podcast. He's been working on his own homebrew RPG. Project name is Rags to
Blast Radius.
Because it's all about growing characters in a fantasy world, growing from being just poor, you know, scraping the gutter to survive, to being these basically giant
action points.
You get a bunch of wealth, you kill a bunch of things, and all of a sudden you get to throw your weight around. And it's all about a lot of his mechanics have to deal with your reputation having an effect on the game world. So he's been bouncing. He's got a couple different takes on that. He's working on a couple different ideas, but that one he's been doing for a while, and it's always funny when he pitches it because he's got a very specific setting for it too. So that's a possibility, but it's pretty cool.
This is primarily a video game site. We cover all sorts of RPGs. So do you want to mention any favorites from there? Say something controversial about Final Fantasy so I get attention.
I don't know how controversial it is, but I haven't liked a Final Fantasy since 6. Ever since it went 3D, I can't stand them. My Super Nintendo Final Fantasies are by far and away the best, and I've never played one after that that I could get into at all. I mean, even 7, I only got out of... I think I got out of Midgard, and I was like, oh, wow, so that's the first part of the game. You know what? Let's just call that the game. I'm the hero. I win. See ya.
The editor-in-chief actually did sort of a retro review of 7 a while back, 2 weeks ago, and the flames have finally died out. it was hilarious for a while.
That kind of thing usually is when you try to attack somebody's nostalgia.
Oh, it wasn't even an attack. He gave the game a 3 out of 5.
That's not bad at all.
And we're a site that, you know, actually uses the whole scale. So 3 out of 5 is what a lot of average to good games get.
Sure.
But any favorites you want to talk about?
Well, I mean, I am widely known for my video game whoreness in that I switch games a lot, and after inviting people to play with me, I am a big multiplayer gamer. I will play a game for the single player, but in general, I will stick around. I will only invest in games that are going to have a long life for multiplayer. for instance, I'm really looking forward to Black Ops coming out here in a couple weeks, because I love Call of Duty, and even though Modern Warfare 2, I thought they really messed up the multiplayer compared to how they did Modern Warfare 1, which was amazing and probably my favorite shooter of all time, I'm willing to give them another chance and see how they do on Black Ops, because it sure does look cool. But what I'm playing right now, basically I'm playing Minecraft in multiplayer mode, because that game, I usually don't like games that don't have objectives. I like The Sims. I just don't find that fun. There's something about Minecraft I can't quit playing. You know, you get 15 guys on a server all building stuff and creating this world. That's just pretty cool. And I can't wait as more and more features roll out for that game, because it's still an alpha, to see where they go, because there's so many things you can do with that are cool. And the other game I'm playing a ton is StarCraft 2, because I've played StarCraft since it came out, and I don't plan on stopping anytime soon. So absolutely love StarCraft 2. I mean, it is just StarCraft with a new coat of paint and a couple new units, but
that's all anyone wanted.
I'd say there's really nothing wrong with that. It's a ton of fun. And I think there's single player in StarCraft 2. While the story left me a little wanting by the end, I really enjoyed the missions and the multiple challenges, and there's a lot of replayability and just a lot of variety. I thought it was an excellent game. I mean, Blizzard is one of the only companies that I will buy pretty much any of their products sight unseen, except for Warcraft, World of Warcraft stuff. I don't do MMOs.
All right. All right, so is there anything in the world of video RPGs you're looking forward to?
Video RPGs? That's a good question. I wait a while for New Vegas. But I really dug Fallout 3. Tell you what, RPG-wise, the biggest thing I'm kind of looking forward to is eventually once my addiction to StarCraft dies down, I plan on getting a Planescape Torment from Good Old Games and reliving one of my favorite RPGs of all time. And then probably doing Baldur's Gate 1 and 2. I kind of want to do an old BioWare end run, a marathon, if you will.
Yeah, the Infinity Engine Marathon.
Yeah, except for I'll skip Icewind Dale, because that was not as good as...
Well, that wasn't BioWare.
That wasn't BioWare? You sure?
No, that was Black Isle and someone else.
Ah, gotcha. Well, so was the original Baldur's Gate, though. That was Black Isle, right? That wasn't BioWare. I messed up.
Yeah.
Yeah, so... Yeah, anyway, those games are... ever since GOG came out with those, I've just been eyeing them. Like, I will pick them up soon.
At the price point's $10. It's so tempting to not do it.
Seriously, $10 for a game? I mean, for classics like that, that's...
Like, how do you say no to Planescape Torment for $10?
Yeah, I know. It's so cheap and so easy. Mm-hmm. The other RPGs, I'm a big fan of Spiderweb Software's little indie RPGs they've been making for years. The Geneforge series, I think, is awesome. Super clunky user interface, really, really poor graphics, but... They get everything they can out of that engine, where they good stories, cool ideas, and they really don't get enough attention because their games do look really, really poor. So unless you are a really hardcore RPG PC gamer, you're probably never heard of them. But Spiderweb Software does some cool stuff. Highly recommend the Geneforge series.
Thanks for mentioning those, because now I can count that as indie PC RPG coverage to shut up some of the guys on our forum. Every other week we get a guy who's like, why don't you talk about more PC RPGs?
I'll tell you another one that does not suck, that is also indie, and that is Echelon. Echelon Book 1 came out about 2 years ago, and it is a old school RPG. Isometric graphics, pretty cool. Like I said, kind of a step above the Spiderweb game stuff graphic-wise. Very, very D&D oriented, with a few other options. And I found it to be a lot of fun. And I think the book 2, the sequel, which I believe you can import characters to, which is one of my favorite old features of games. I think if it's not out yet, it's out soon. So I mean, there's some. If you like old school PC RPGs, these are the companies that are still making them.
All right, so any last thoughts before we say goodbye?
Buy Iron Tyrants. It's awesome. If you like giant robots and you like rolling dice, you cannot go wrong with this game. $25. Booyah. And that gets you the PDF. That gets you the book and the PDF for free. Bam. There you go.
All right, good night. We'll be right back. just very, very nice and informative. I mean, on the one hand, you have someone telling you, but then there's just the shock of that.
Well, technically, they have to tell us, I think, by law. So at least they're following up on it.
Yeah, I guess. Now, I'm drinking the good beer brewed in Guelph. There are two breweries in that town.
Uh-huh. Which are?
There's the Duke of Wellington.
Okay.
Which does a lot of really sort of Englishy style things.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Sleeman, which is junk.
Fair enough.
Got closed down during Prohibition. No one missed it for 60 years. All I'm going to say.
That sounds, you know, we have Anheuser-Busch here, and along with a bunch of other famous breweries from way before Prohibition. But since Prohibition came along and, you know, changed our beer industry, it's not all that good. I mean, I drink Bud Light and a few other Bud products because they're ubiquitous and easy to drink, but they're not good beers.
No, no, they are not. Actually, that's sort of my best story was at a party once, I sort of turned my nose up at someone drinking Bud Light Lime. And he said, oh, have you had it? Because you really shouldn't judge it till you've tried it. At which point, I grabbed the beer from his hand, knocked back a big gulp of it, put it back in his hand, looked him dead in the eye, and said, no, that's terrible.
You know, it's weird. I think Bud Light Lime is good for, it's a nice, really super hot day beer. Like, it's really light, it's really crisp, there's nothing to it, and it's a little bit more tasty, I think, than a Corona with a lime in it, so I'm okay with it. It's not something I'd sit down and drink, you know, at a bar at night or dinner, but if you're out and about a hot party in the middle of summertime, it's all right. It does the job.
Like, I'd be with you on that. Like, from what it tasted like, it's something that I wouldn't mind having after mowing the lawn in the middle of August or something.
Yeah, exactly.
But then I found the ultimate beer for that situation.
Which is what?
Mill Street's lemon tea.
I don't think we can get that down here.
It is in cans, so I'm sure it'll start making its way.
I'll have to look. Yeah, I do miss, I spent some time in Australia, and I miss the beer there with the higher alcohol content and it being, you know, good.
The one I'm drinking right now is called Iron Duke. It is 6.5 by alcohol volume.
That's not much more than here. I think, though, I was drinking a lot of Crown Lager down there, and I think that was 7 or 8% alcohol. Wasn't too high, but you know, it wasn't wine, but it was still good.
Yeah. I suppose we should talk about why I really brought you on the show.
Oh, the topic.
Yes. The topic. I suppose I should introduce you. We should do like some sort of introduction thing. I'll tack all this on to the end because it's funny.
Fair enough.
But.